A space station crashes to Earth, this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. Has it happened yet? As we finished producing this week's show, Tiangong 1 had not yet re-entered Earth's atmosphere, creating a magnificent fireworks show that would leave souvenirs on the ground. No one knows more about space debris than the Aerospace Corporation's Bill Ayler, and we've got him on this week's show. The Chinese space station is also on Bruce Betts' mind. We'll talk about it and much more on What's Up. NASA finally has a budget for the current fiscal year. Casey Dreyer will bring us the highlights. And we begin this big episode with Planetary Society Senior Editor Emily Lakdawalla. Emily, welcome back from LPSC. I know it's one of your favorites every year, the Lunar and Planetary Science Conference. How tough is it to decide what you're going to be able to report on?
Well, it doesn't help that I want to clone myself every year so that I can appear in multiple rooms. It does help that there are a lot of people who have the same problem. And so we all tweet for each other. We can follow notes. And this year, I actually started an effort to do collaborative note-taking. So one of the blog posts that I don't have up yet, but which I hope to have up soon, will be a link to some of those collaboratively taken notes so you can actually see what people wrote down while they were in the sessions.
And you've recruited some great guest bloggers too, haven't you?
Yeah, that's right. I've already got a post up by Jake Robbins about Mars downslope mass wasting processes. And I've got a few more in the pipeline, one on Galilean satellites, one on the moon. There's a lot of good stuff coming.
Let's talk about your post that I just read a few minutes ago. Titan is terrific. And you give plenty of evidence for that. But even here, you had to sort of be picky about what you could report on.
You know, when you have a mission that's operated for 14 years like Cassini did at Saturn, a lot of the updates you see at conferences are kind of incremental reports on how a particular line of research has advanced a little bit since the last meeting. And so what I was really more drawn to were a couple of the more out there presentations in the Titan session. Two of them started off whole new fields of study for Titan. So one of them was by Morgan Cable, and she was talking about molecular minerals on Titan. Now, if you're a geologist, a mineral is a naturally occurring crystalline substance with an orderly arrangement of its atoms and a fixed chemical composition. And on Earth, those are made with things like iron and oxygen and silica and magnesium. On Titan, they'd be made of small organic molecules. And she was doing experiments in the lab with molecules like ethane, acetylene, propane, hydrogen cyanide. These are all things that exist on Titan's surface and which make OSHA just throw up their hands and scream about all these materials that are in the laboratory. But she's doing some pretty interesting work looking at the kinds of crystals that you'd expect to form the organic minerals on Titan and finding that some of them have some pretty interesting behavior, like how they might expand quite a lot when they warm up, which would cause tectonics on the surface. So that was really interesting.
And maybe even forming rings around Titan lakes, rings around the bathtub, so to speak.
That's right. We've seen these light deposits around lakes on Titan. We don't actually know if they're deposits, but they're these light rings around the lakes. And who knows, they could be evaporite deposits, maybe, or they might be something else. Who knows?
Emily, thank you. There's so much more at planetary.org than this one blog post that you put there on March 21st. And we'll look for more from you and from those guest bloggers that you mentioned.
That's right. I'll have many posts up this week.
Emily Lakdawalla is the senior editor for the Planetary Society, and she joins us from time to time here on the show. On now to Casey Dreyer, the director of space policy for the Planetary Society, with an update on what looks to be a really good NASA budget.
Matt, this isn't good news. This is spectacular news. This is really good budget for NASA and for science just broadly within the U.S. government. I believe this may be the best year for U.S. investment in science in a decade, if not more.
Very impressive. All right, now let's stick to NASA, although NOAA and others, you point out, do pretty well as well. What are you most happy about in the NASA budget?
Where do I begin? Big picture, NASA got $20.7 billion. That was the compromise that it's, you know, the House had originally proposed $19.8 billion for NASA, $19.9. The Senate had proposed $19.6, and the compromise was $20.7. Now, that's a compromise everyone can get behind. The pie got bigger, so everyone's slice got to grow, and no one really had to pay the price. Planetary science, obviously our main focus here at the Planetary Society, grew to its largest budget, I think, in history. It gets a little hard to go out way back in time to the 70s just because of the programmatic differences between the programs. $2.2 billion for planetary science. It was not that long ago that we were talking about 1.5 and just struggling to get to that after a decade of cuts to planetary science. So a spectacular number for planetary science. It supports Europa. It supports Mars. They have a lot of Planetary Society priorities are included in there, including recommendations that we made last year for investing in Mars sample return and a science orbiter, extra $75 million for that. NEOCAM, that asteroid hunting space telescope, lives to develop another year. It gets a minimal amount of funding to keep that mission on life support. That was an important win for us. And then, of course, there's just broad support in all of the sciences grew. NASA science grew to over $6 billion this year. It's just a spectacular number.
Casey, it was only this morning as we speak that we learned from NASA that the JWST, the James Webb Space Telescope, is going to be delayed even further. Do you see that having any effect on spending this year and in the next few years?
Well, spending this year is now set. So this budget that just passed actually kind of retroactively applies to the fiscal year that began in October of 2017. So we're already halfway through it. In that budget, they gave the requested amount to James Webb, about $500 million. And they also gave money to what is meant to be the successor of James Webb, the WFIRST Space Telescope. Let me see if I can do this off the top of my head. The Wide Field Infrared Survey Telescope.
Yeah, well done. WFIRST. Well done. That's it.
It's what I get paid to do, Matt. And this has been actually proposed to be canceled next year in the 2019 fiscal year by the White House. Now, there's been a campaign to try to restate that funding, and Congress notably included $150 million for 2018, this year, to continue that mission. So not exactly a big statement of support for cancellation by Congress. But now that James Webb is blown its budget again, that difference, the idea that James Webb, the cost of that would diminish over time to just transfer into operations, that would open up this new funding wedge, as they call it in NASA parlance, to be used by WFIRST. Now that James Webb will likely not give up that funding for at least the next couple of years, that makes it a lot harder to begin working on WFIRST in earnest, even if it weren't going to be canceled.
Wow, the one sour note in all of this. If you'd like to read about all of the great news that Casey has just talked about and much more, it's in his blog entry for March 22 of this year. It's even been updated to indicate how the White House has signed it into law. It's all there at planetary.org, including a terrific table that traces the development of this budget. Casey, thanks very much. I look forward to talking to you next week, the first Friday of April, when we'll be joined by Jason Callahan for that month's Space Policy Edition.
Absolutely, Matt. Let's accentuate the positive until that point.
Casey Dreyer, he is the Director of Space Policy for the Planetary Society. Stay with us in just a few moments. We'll talk about a big piece of metal that's coming down really soon, if it hasn't already. That's when Planetary Radio continues in a minute.
Hello, I'm Robert Picardo, Planetary Society board member and now the host of the Society's Planetary Post video newsletter. There's a new edition every month. We've already gone behind the scenes at JPL, partied at Yuri's Night, and visited with CEO Bill Nye. We've also got the month's top headlines from around the solar system. You can sign up at planetary.org/connect. When you do, you'll be among the first to see each new show. I hope you'll join us.
Hi, Emily Lakdawalla here with big news from the Planetary Society. We're rolling out a new membership plan with great benefits and expanded levels of participation. At the Planetary Society, passionate space fans like you join forces to create missions, nurture new science and technology, advocate for space, and educate the world. Details are at planetary.org/membership. I'll see you around the solar system.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. It isn't every day that a space station crashes back to Earth, But avoiding space junk that is still in low Earth orbit is a daily concern for everyone from the operators of the smallest CubeSats up to the astronauts and cosmonauts on the International Space Station, where something as small as a loose screw could ruin your whole day. Bill Ayler has been studying our crowded skies at the Aerospace Corporation for 44 years. He was chief engineer for the company's Center for Orbital and Reentry Debris Studies and continues his long tenure as an aerospace fellow. Some of you will remember him because of his parallel involvement with planetary defense, making sure we find, track, and when it becomes necessary, deflect a comet or asteroid on a collision path with our world. Catch the podcast version of this week's show if you'd like to hear Bill talk about debris in space and our crowded skies, and he'll review the status of planetary defense against near-Earth objects. Extended conversations with Emily and Casey are there, too. Bill recently spoke to me from his office on the sprawling aerospace campus in Southern California. Bill, welcome back to Planetary Radio. It is great to get you back on the show. I'm only sorry that we're not doing this from a planetary defense conference, because you know I've had the best time at the two of those that I've attended.
Matt, it's good talking to you too, and I'm glad you've enjoyed the conferences.
We'll get back to that, the PDC. I didn't make it to the last one, but I sure hope to get to the next one, but because there's something much more immediate for us to talk about. Something is going to be falling out of orbit in just the next few days. In fact, by the time a lot of people hear this program, it may have already happened. Tell us what we should expect by the reentry of this Chinese space station.
It certainly is coming down, that much we know. And it will reenter the atmosphere at some place we don't know where exactly, and probably won't know very well, even when it does come in. So it'll be quite a spectacular view for some lucky people if they have to see it. It's a reasonable chance nobody will see it at all.
So there's going to be quite a show in the sky for the people who are not far away.
Oh, it'd be magnificent. The way these things work is, it hits the atmosphere, the friction with the atmosphere at those high altitudes gradually heats it up. It comes apart into big pieces first and then little pieces, and things shed off. And it's like a fireworks show. It's really a beautiful thing to see. It lasts a couple of minutes. That's what sort of makes it different than a meteor shower.
Should I be hoping that I'll be under this to catch that show, or would it be much better if it happens far away from any place inhabited?
We hope it happens somewhere where there's nobody around. I mean, if you happen to see it, there's a real good chance that the debris isn't going to fall on your head. So that's one good thing. But clearly on these kinds of things, there may be some danger, some hazardous fragments that come down and survive. So it'd be better not to be under the final footprint.
So I've read differing accounts in the media, some that say, yes, some fragments are likely to survive, and others that say, no, we probably will see it all burn up in the atmosphere. It sounds like you're saying the former is the case, that probably some of this space station is going to make it down to terra firma.
Oh, yes, I think so. Generally, objects this size, we would expect to see anywhere from, say, 10 to 40% of its mass on orbit to reenter and survive. It just depends on what it's made of and so forth, but there's a lot of evidence that these kinds of things, that fragments of these things survive and will hit the ground.
This is not the first space station or large object in orbit that has come back in this case, in kind of an uncontrolled way, right? I mean, what have we seen in the past?
Oh, that's correct. This is an uncontrolled reentry, which means that the atmosphere just sort of drags it down and it comes in wherever it pleases. A controlled reentry would be one that brings an object down into an area where it's definitely not going to be a hazard. Uncontrolled reentry is probably the largest one that's ever occurred, was the United States Skylab, which came down in 1979. And that one weighed about 69,000 kilograms. That's a big object. So Tiangong is around 8,000 to 9,000 kilograms, so much smaller. But generally, a controlled reentry would be, say, for example, the space shuttle. Space shuttle was designed to land in a particular place. And so basically you command a rocket on board that object to execute a deorbit burn, and that will place it in a particular area on the planet. And a general place for dumping things is in the South Pacific.
Just because it's big and wide open and not very many things for it to fall on other than water and fish.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Why would China not have had this reenter as a in a controlled way? I've read that they may have lost control or lost contact with the space station.
Yes, that's what I've heard as well. So basically, if having a controlled reentry requires a couple of things. Number one, you need to know what attitude your vehicle is so you can make sure when you fire that rocket, it's fired in the right direction. And then secondly, you need to have a rocket on board that you can fire. It's not clear exactly what happened, but it looks like they lost control of this particular one. So you can't, they couldn't control the attitude to do a burn, which would mean that if they did one, it would still come down some random place, so that it doesn't buy you much. Also, you would need some propellant on board to do that. We really don't know what the circumstance is right now.
Talk more about the factors that make it so difficult to determine when and where an uncontrolled object like this will return to Earth.
For an uncontrolled object like this that's coming down, even up at the altitudes where the space station is, for example, there is just a little bit of atmosphere up there. And that is slowly bringing down the space station. And if we didn't do a burn every now and then to raise it up a little bit, it would come back down in some period of time. And same thing for this particular one. It just kind of slowly coming down. It's coming down through the upper levels of the layers of the atmosphere. And you start getting in a little closer, the atmospheric density variations begin to have a greater impact or a greater effect on the eventual reentry time and so forth. And if you have a solar storm or any kind of solar activity like that, or there are other physical things that can happen that will affect the atmosphere. So anything like that will change the eventual reentry time. For example, if you have a solar storm, it actually causes the atmosphere to bloom a little bit. It sort of rises up, becomes a little bit more dense at some of these higher altitudes. And those kinds of changes will of course affect the object that is coming down. This thing's traveling about 4 miles a second. It does see a little bit of drag, and that little bit of those accumulative effects will affect where it comes in.
Space stations are, of course, not aerodynamically designed because they don't have to deal with aerodynamics. So they tend to have bits and pieces all over them and their odd shapes. How much does the shape of an object affect this atmospheric drag?
That's an excellent point. And the orientation also affects where something's going to come down. For example, if you can imagine an arrow in space, if you had the arrow pointing into the wind, it doesn't see so much. Even down on Earth, it will go a fairly good distance. But if you turn the arrow broadside, then that means that it'll slow down much quicker. Same thing happens in space. And as a matter of fact, Skylab, when it was coming down, there was a little bit of control at that time of the attitude. And so the body was actually rotated to make it slow down more in some areas. And that was used as a way of controlling what orbit it came down in so that you could have a reentry that came down more inclined to come in over water.
So with this object, Tiangong 1, how long before actual reentry will we know more? I mean, we'll be able to say, yes, it looks like it's coming down in the South Pacific or the Indian Ocean or, for that matter, Kansas.
We may not be quite as precise as that even, I hate to say. What's required to do a good job of predicting is to get information or, you know, have some observations, shall we say, late in the reentry. So as many observations as you can get is helpful. And then, of course, as you get one that's, a day or a few hours away from the actual reentry point, that can help you refine it even more. And then even then, there's a certain amount of uncertainty in, you know, again, how the object is going to, you know, how it's going to be oriented. It may be tumbling. It may be coming in broadside. You just don't know. And then also there are atmospheric variations that will affect things. So getting a very precise impact location is nearly impossible. And let me mention that the reentry location is one thing. The second thing is that there's a lot of uncertainty in how that the eventual footprint, how the object breaks up, where those pieces will be distributed on the ground. So there's even more uncertainty in that.
I assume that these could be spread over quite a wide area.
Yes, indeed, they can. As a matter of fact, they're generally spread right along the ground track of this thing. So namely, it's if you look on these maps, you see that there's a line that says this is where it is over the Earth. So the debris will fall somewhere along that ground track. And it'll be basically a long, thin thing, maybe 400 or 500 miles long and maybe 30 miles wide. The width sort of depends on the what winds are happening and doing to debris as it falls. The length depends on how much material is in the particular object and what the breakup sequence is.
Bill, there is a great photo of you that we'll put up a link to, and maybe we'll be able to put that photo separately up on the show page for this show that people can find at planetary.org/radio. And it's you actually looking through a piece of space debris that I have seen on the aerospace campus in the Los Angeles area. I just want to thank you for spending so many years trying to protect us and objects in space from each other and from disaster.
Well, thank you. It's been a lot of fun. I've enjoyed it. You know, it's one thing about the aerospace business. There's always something new and exciting going on. I've been happy to be part of it.
Thanks again, Bill. Bill Ayler, he is an aerospace fellow now at the Aerospace Corporation, one time principal engineer for the Center for Orbital and Reentry Debris Study. The acronym is CORDS. He's done a lot of other great work during his time there. And he is also, as far as I can tell, the primary power behind the biannual Planetary Defense Conference that brings together experts in really every field from across the world to talk about the danger that our planet faces, that our civilization faces from near-Earth objects. We'll be back in just a moment, as promised, with Bruce Betts for this week's edition of What's Up. Time for What's Up on Planetary Radio for this end of March episode of our program. We have Bruce Betts, the chief scientist of the Planetary Society, on the other end of this line. I wanted to share with you up front, hello, first of all.
Hello.
Stanley Fertig in Brooklyn, New York, loved your show on PlanetVac. He says he was fortunate enough to visit Honeybee Robotics Brooklyn headquarters a couple of years ago. Now he wants to get a PlanetVac to clean up his basement.
Well, we'll work on that. The commercial spinoff.
Robots in Brooklyn. I can't do the accent.
I'm not even going to try.
Just tell us about the night sky.
The big groovy cool thing happening is that Mars and Saturn are getting really snuggly and close in the night sky. They're actually coming up at 2 in the morning or so, but if you go on the pre-dawn, you can look in the east, southeast. Two objects, both bright, similar brightness. Mars is the reddish one. Saturn's the yellowish one. They will be particularly close on April 2nd, then grow apart again. So you can watch them come together and then separate. It's very exciting, Matt. Very exciting. Evening sky, we've got Venus looking super bright low in the west shortly after sunset, and Jupiter hanging out coming up around 10, 11 p.m. in the east looking super bright. We move on to this week in space history. It was 1974. We had the first ever spacecraft flyby of Mercury with Mariner 10. Gave us our first close-up looks at the inner planet.
And not repeated for so many years. How much of it did we still need to see?
About half. Mariner 10 did three flybys, but the way the orbital dynamics worked, it basically saw the same side every time. So we had to wait for Messenger to go by in 2008 and then orbit in 2011. And then we got the whole planet.
Yeah. And until then, who knows what we would have were to find on the other half of that planet. Could have been giant billboards or flying saucers or anything unlikely.
Well, yeah. But fortunately, they were all moved before 2008.
They saw us coming.
Exactly. Clever, clever alien creature Mercurians. We move on to, but seriously, folks, we move on to random space fact.
Well played.
You've been talking this show about Tiangong 1. Seems rather big when it's going to re-enter the Earth's atmosphere, but really was a very small space station. For reference, NASA's Orion capsule that's currently under development has a larger pressurized volume than Tiangong 1 does. Almost 20 cubic meters compared to 15, though only about half of Orion's pressurized volume is said by NASA to be habitable, by which I assume they mean where humans can hang out, but maybe there are flesh-eating aliens in the other half. I don't know.
From Mercury, no doubt.
They had to go somewhere.
Boy, I'm sorry for the guys who had to live there, guys and girls who had to live there for a while.
All right, we move on to the trivia contest. I asked you, of the 88 modern constellations, which is the smallest in area? So solid angles subtended, to say it more formally. How'd we do, Matt?
We got a really nice response for this with our standard prize package. And it was a brand new listener, someone who just wrote to me a couple of weeks ago to say he's so glad that he has found the show. He's loving it. He regrets it took him this long to discover it. It also delayed his opportunity to win. That's Jeremy Zuccarello in State College, Pennsylvania. He says that that smallest of the 88 constellations, recognized constellations, is the crux, or as so many people pointed out to us, fans of Crosby, Stills, and Nash, the Southern Cross, correct?
Yes, although you don't have to be a fan of Crosby, Stills, and Nash to still appreciate Southern Cross.
Doesn't hurt. He said area of roughly 68.5 square degrees, or about 5% of the biggest of those 88, Hydra. So it is little, and it's really cute, and it's hard to miss, too, since I've actually been down there in the Southern Hemisphere exactly once, and it's pretty up in the sky.
Pretty.
We're ready to move on.
So back to Tiangong 1. What missions visited the Tiangong 1 space station? Name all the missions that visited it. Go to planetary.org/radio contest.
And no, we did not mention that, or at least Bill Ayler didn't mention that. So good on you. That's a great follow-up to the contest. And you have this time until Wednesday, April 4th at 8 a.m. Pacific time to get us your answer. And if you are chosen by random.org and have got the right answer, you might just win yourself something very special. We got a note from Perry Metzger in New York, New York. He says, did you know that rubber asteroids aren't even available for purchase online? Even Alibaba, China's largest source of random products for sale, doesn't list any. Well, that's because we took rubber rocks and relabeled them rubber asteroids. But if you get them back in stock, he says, Planetary Society would dominate the market. It's a huge market for rubber asteroids. I decided, based on Perry's note, to go into my secret and very small stash of remaining rubber asteroids.
I knew it. I knew you had a secret stash.
Stay out of my desk. We will award the winner this time a Planetary Society rubber asteroid, the rarest asteroid type in the world, in the universe. And...
is that an R-type asteroid?
Yeah, it's either that or B for bounce. It's that and an itelescope.net account, a 200-point account on that nonprofit network, a worldwide network of telescopes that you can use to look all over that that same universe. Maybe you'll find a rubber asteroid out there somewhere.
All right, everybody, go out there, look up the night sky, and think about, in general, what is the crux of the matter. Thank you and good night.
He's Bruce Betts, the chief scientist, the crux of all science at the Planetary Society, who joins us every week for What's Up. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by its watchful members. Mary Liz Bender is our associate producer. Josh Doyle composed our theme, which was arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. I'm Matt Kaplan, Ad Astra.